And we are your first panel. I'm going to introduce the panel. The panel is going to speak about the presidency and Congress, and it's going to talk about the unit, no, we're not talking, that's the general theme, agency, autonomy, and the unitary executive, which is hard to keep in mind, that title. I have on my left, Judge Silberman. Judge Silberman is a graduate of Harvard Law School. He was the solicitor and undersecretary of the Department of Labor. He was deputy attorney general of the United States in 1975. And since 1985, he's been a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit. Okay. We'll then hear from Mr. Terry Eastland. Oh, I should mention that Judge Silberman was an author of an opinion that unfortunately the Supreme Court, or fortunately, depending on your point of view, did not see eye to eye with in the special prosecutor case. I will say I thought it was an excellent opinion. That's to say nothing about the result. We have on my right, Terry Eastland. We have on my right, Don Elliott. Don Elliott is a graduate of the Yale Law School. Judge Silberman, who was from Harvard, thinks that Yale is an acronym for Youth Against Learning and Education. Don has written extensively in administrative law. He has written about separation of powers. He is currently general counsel of the EPA, where he will be put into practice, or try to put into practice, some of the substantive theories that underlie some of his writings. Finally, we have Terry Eastland. Terry is a graduate of Vanderbilt and of Oxford. I do not know what those acronyms stand for. He had a career in the press. He had a distinguished and very interesting career in the Department of Justice. I asked him his title, and he said Eminence Grise. Not true. He has written and is writing on the president, on separation of powers. You will soon be able to read his book on the presidency and his own views about that organization as an institution. He currently is a resident scholar at the National Legal Center for the Public Interest. My name is Stephen Breyer. I'm a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. I did work in Washington. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come back to Washington, the entertainment capital of the world. What I'm going to try to do, and we're going to try to stick to our time limit of 10 minutes each, what I'm going to try to do is to go into this very complex subject, opening up as many issues as possible, a subject that we could spend months upon in 10 minutes, which will allow me to try to do what we all do so well. For we know Blackstone's definition of a lawyer, one who can plumb the very depths of the superficial. I'm going to make 4 points. The 4 points I want to make on this subject are the following. First, that the constitutional doctrine of separation of powers is not much of a constraint and doesn't have much to do with the question. Second, that there are 4 or 5 serious institutional difficulties that plague the president in his efforts to control his own branch. Third, that the underlying problem of coordination is indeed a problem, a big one. And that fourth, we are only beginning to scratch the surface in our search for a solution. All right, as to the first point, and here I hope I'll get a little disagreement from my panel. I think that the constitutional doctrine of separation of powers is not a major constraint because it's so very liberal in what it allows a president and a Congress together to do. That isn't to say they'll always act wisely, That isn't to say the laws will always be good, but there is a difference between what is wise and what is constitutional, and the converse is equally true. And the reason I think those things is because I think the underlying purpose of the separation of powers doctrine is really far removed even from the way we've interpreted the doctrine. What is that purpose? Well, in my exaggerated way, as I see it, I remember an opening paragraph of a book I found awfully hard to get through by Michel Foucault, where he talks about Damien, who was the assassin of Louis XV, who failed, and because when he failed, he was sentenced to be torn and quartered and boiled in oil and hung by the gibbet or whatever they did, and it sounded terrible. He, by the way, is best known for the best understatement in history. When they woke him up the morning of his execution, said, "Are you ready to be hung, quartered, boiled in oil, had your limbs torn?" He said, "It's going to be a rough day." That's it, right. All right. But the point is, why was there that terrible torture? And the answer is because all law was embodied in the king. To break any law was to attack the king himself. And to break a law, the king's law, by physically attacking a king, was obviously deserving of only the most terrible punishment. And the reason that image is useful is because in thinking about it, one can see an individual as embodiment of law. And one can then imagine the arbitrary behavior that can take place when there is no clear distinction between enactment of the law, enforcement of the law, and attack upon an individual. And that's why Montesquieu said the key thing is have one group of people legislate and a different group of people enforce. That prevents the embodiment of an individual, it prevents the vendetta, and that's why there should be three branches of government, which Montesquieu said were the executive, the legislative, and foreign affairs. Interesting, right? Interesting, right. Okay. Now, we've come a long way, even in the Constitution, since that. And what we've said in the Constitution, of course, is our three branches, and the Supreme Court's interpreted it. But as I read through all those cases, though, you know, trying to put my own teaching's function of making them all fit into neat categories and so forth, my categorization efforts, I end up thinking, well, if the Constitution literally says you can't give the power to that branch, they can't do it, then of course you can't do it. That's the Chadha case. That's the veto case, all right? And if the Constitution, well, if there's just no relationship between what the branch is supposed to do and the power you're giving them, I guess you can't do it. And if, in fact, you give a power to this branch, and in giving the power to that branch, if they really are making some other branch almost impossible to do their job, then I guess you can't do it. But those are fairly weak constraints. And if I want to use case names, and if I think of them as being fairly weak constraints, I think, well, Mistretta, the Sentencing Commission case, and not Boucher, the GAO case. Mistretta is the wave of the future. And if I'm right about that, then it's a weak constraint. All right, that's point one, up for argument. Point two, but there really are difficulties in the president coordinating his own branch. Where do they come from? Well, think of four. One, amazing to a European, amazing. The statutes do not give the president the power. The statutes don't say the president shall. They say the administrator shall. They say the board shall. They say the commission shall. They say the secretary shall. They hardly ever say the president shall. And therefore, the individual decisions are given down deep in the bureaucracy, or at least below the top level. Well, can't the president just say, oh, I'll fire him if he doesn't do what I say. I'll fire him. Firing is easy to say. Remember my story of my friend in the 1960s, Phil Hyman, became at a very young age assistant secretary of state. He became because a person, Abba Schwartz, became assistant secretary of state, and because of Abba Schwartz's views about one of his subordinates named Frances Knight, whom a lot of people, liberals, didn't like too much because she had a lot of policies they didn't like, and Abba Schwartz, being a pretty good liberal, became, he was her boss. I'll fire her. I'll transfer her. She's my subordinate, isn't she? Well, there were, I think, 8 hours, 10 hours between the time he wrote that transfer order and between the time he was out of office. It was his subordinate, wasn't it? Fire J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, not so hard, is it? It's on paper. All right, firing a person is a major political responsibility, depending on the person. It's just possible that the president is not going to run the heat of firing so-and-so because he doesn't like the person's ruling on the length of lawnmower blades. All right? Yet, government is made up of lawnmower blades, if you see what I mean. All right? And firing, not always the solution. Problem, right? Problem when we decide to legalize the tremendous number of detailed decisions, not just on who's entitled to what money, but on making rules, where rules are policy. There are EPA rules, there are OSHA rules, there are major policy decisions. And I think, and this reflects a little bit my life as a judge, I think I can run a fairly fair proceeding. I think I can decide on the record reasonably fairly, at least I try. I don't think I have the tools at my disposal to find out the legislative type facts, Ken Davis, necessary to make major policy decisions of the sorts that underlie rules. For there, I need a telephone. And I have to be able to call whom I want, not whom the lawyers put in the record. All right? And yet we've judicialized lots of those proceedings. And there are good reasons for doing it. There are good reasons for all these things. But try to have judicial proceedings, type proceedings with their isolation, records, formal requirements, et cetera, on major policy matters, and then keep the president out. All right? And then have everything in the sunshine. Sunshine's great. Everybody's in favor of sunshine. Except I've also noticed that if you make major policy decision makers do everything in the sunshine, they may not say what they're actually thinking, particularly on political issues. So throw that in too, you see. And now we have a mix where it's tough for the president, tough for him to control his own branch. Is there still a need? I have 1 minute left, and I've got to keep them to their time limits too. So I'll just say, yes, there is a need. Why is there a need? There's a need because we have one agency saying that, I'll parody it a little. Don't eat apples with Al Ars, all right? In order not to run a risk, 3 trillion grapes. Does that ring a bell? All right, risk of death. What about the same as lightning striking you? And the other agencies, well, you know, we don't want to be too tough on the tobacco industry. Suppose we took, you know, like 1/10 of the money the Al Ars rule costs us and spent it on tobacco, i.e., not promoting it, all right, stopping it. And suppose we compared the number of lives saved. Of course there's a need for coordination. Of course the need becomes more pressing in this smaller and smaller world. Tool to deal with the problem. An agency you've never heard of called OIRA over in OMB with 40 people who are not lawyers, who are sent out there to deal with a bureaucracy of 10,000 without necessarily the political visibility that will allow them to enforce their decisions. We'll talk about that. Even if they succeed, can they cure the problem? That's my final point. That's going to be up to you. We still have Congress, and you're going to hear a lot about that later on. All I've tried to do is sketch out there is a problem. I don't know it's going to be constitutionally solved. We need institutions to do it, and to give you a few reasons why that'll be tough.
You went over 2 minutes. I have the 2 minutes. Asking me to speak on the doctrine of the unitary executive is very much like asking General George Pickett to speak on the future of the Confederacy after the Battle of Gettysburg. Just as historians love to point as Pickett's charge as the high watermark of the South's effort to secede, some legal scholars have labeled my opinion, in which my colleague Steve Williams joined and collaborated, as the brief apogee of a constitutional lost cause. As I listened to Steve, it sounds very lost indeed. Our decision, and even more Justice Scalia's dissent, issued when the circus arrived at the big tent, are described in much of the literature as extreme examples of a formalist approach to separation of powers jurisprudence. It was not until I was a judge for some time, having lost track of the dominant currents in American law schools, that I realized that formalism was a pejorative. It never occurred to me that strict adherence to prescribed forms, which is how the dictionary defines formalism, was a bad characteristic for a judge or a lawyer. Certainly, such an approach to the First Amendment has not similarly demigrated. But labels notwithstanding, I have the impression that views on separation of powers, and particularly the concept of the unitary executive, are not uninfluenced by contemporary political trends. Of course, there are exceptions, but many of those who are most hostile to a presidential claim to exercise all executive power are similarly hostile to the politics of the majority of recent presidents. Of course, the opposite may also be true, and where you stand may depend on where you sit or have sat. I've often wondered if my own views would have been different had I served, as did several of my colleagues in the legislative branch, particularly during a period when the president was of another party. Of one thing, however, I am sure. Had the issue presented in Morrison v. Olson been presented at a different time, in a different context, the prevailing academic reaction also would have been entirely different. Let us suppose that another kind of independent counsel law, call it, if you will, the Loyalty in Government Act, had been passed during the Truman administration by the 80th Congress, perhaps like the Taft-Hartley Act, over the president's veto. And let us further suppose the act had been a product of congressional concern, which, as you will recall, did exist, that the Truman administration was insufficiently zealous in rooting out communist or communist sympathizers in senior executive positions. It might well have been said, fairly or unfairly, that the administration had a conflict of interest in investigating and prosecuting such individuals because of the political embarrassment that exposure might bring. I can easily visualize, as I'm sure you can, a senator from Wisconsin, or perhaps from California, introducing such legislation in a fiery floor speech promising an end to the administration's coddling of communists. And it takes little further imagination to picture an independent counsel prosecuting an Alger Hiss or Harry Dexter White under such a statute. And the constitutional question subsequently presented in Morrison v. Olson raised at that time. Is there a single person in this entire room has any doubt at all, where that day's tribes and triblets would have stood? Surely on the side of the unitary executive. I have on occasion very much regretted that we did not experience that exact scenario, because I am also convinced the Supreme Court would have, in that time, in that context, determined the statute unconstitutional. I see Ted Olson watching me very carefully. I'm sorry, Ted, it didn't happen. I do not mean to suggest the Supreme Court's opinion in Morrison v. Olson was dictated by political considerations, although the aftermath of Watergate and the difficulties of the Attorney General at the time of litigation did not help the cause of the unitary executive. No, I think in explaining the court's opinion and thereby determining what is left of the doctrine of the unitary executive, one must focus on another factor entirely: the court's willingness to countenance efforts to split the unitary executive so long as the judiciary remains the final arbiter of intra-executive battles, so long as the judiciary, in a sense, benefits from the damage done to the presidency. At the time the Morrison case came to the courts, the Supreme Court had issued a series of opinions through the 70s and the 80s that seemed to bolster the presidency. I'll move ahead quickly, but I'll refer to Buckley and Vallejo, Chadha and Bauscher, all restricting congressional abilities to interfere with executive power. But I believe it is not coincidental that all those schemes reviewed in those cases shared another characteristic. They did not delegate to the judiciary the application of the check on the executive. After all, the court has for a long time looked much more favorably at various devices that fracture the president's authority, so long as the judiciary remains the coordinator of that split authority. Or to put it another way, perhaps an unkindly way, so long as the federal judiciary is the ultimate beneficiary of the power of coordination which the president lost. That is not to accuse the court so much of conscious self-seeking. Rather, it is to point out that men and institutions are rarely inclined to question their own wise exercise of power. Although in Humphrey's executors, the court justified allowing Congress to place a good cause restriction on the removal of an FTC commissioner, notwithstanding Myers, on grounds recently discarded in Morrison, that the FTC was a quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative body, not a pure executive agency. It should not be forgotten that what constituted or constitutes just cause for removal is a question that the court ultimately controls. Similarly, when the court in the United States versus ICC permitted a lawsuit between the Justice Department and an independent regulatory agency, notwithstanding a claim of non-justiciability, surely it was in part because the court stood ready then, as it does now, to resolve disputes between portions of the executive branch that ended up in court. We saw the court permit litigation between two undeniable portions of the executive branch for the first time, and in my view, ominously, in U.S. versus Nixon. There, the court recognized the standing of a prosecutor appointed by the Attorney General to sue the president. While Nixon surely foreshadowed the demise of the unitary executive, at least the court advanced a shred of a justification in a footnote that the Attorney General himself, an agent of the president, had issued a regulation erecting a barrier to the president removing the special prosecutor. Of course, that regulation itself really represented a congressional slicing of executive power, since it was issued as a condition of the Attorney General's confirmation of the Senate. And the court later, in the opinion, candidly admitted that the obvious encroachment on the executive's, on the president's authority was necessary because the judiciary needed the evidence to carry out its constitutional function, quote, to do justice in criminal prosecutions. Now, after Morrison, there appears to be no principle that protects the president's authority to control his own branch against either overt or covert congressional invasions, so long as Congress is wise enough to divert the lost power ostensibly to the judiciary rather than to itself. Of course, the two key aspects of presidential authority over executive branch personnel are appointment and removal. And I regard removal as more important than my colleague here. The majority in Morrison thought it not constitutionally incongruous for a court to be given the power to appoint those who prosecute criminal cases before it, notwithstanding our constitutional tradition of separating a prosecutor and a judge because of the judiciary's familiarity with criminal process. But in a footnote, the court suggested that the judiciary would have no special knowledge or expertise justifying the power to appoint officials in the Department of Agriculture or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I frankly do not understand why we would be thought more expert in criminal cases than FERC cases. We probably get more of the latter than the former. Still, I suppose the court wished to caution Congress not to assume that the authority to appoint prosecutors would necessarily extend authority to appoint officials responsible for litigating civil programs, even though, in my view, the incongruity is even greater in the criminal field because of a factor that Judge Breyer did not mention, which is the impact on the individual. As for restrictions on the president's removal power, it is simply impossible to glean any indication, let alone principle, out of Morrison that even suggests the boundaries to statutory limitations on a president's authority to remove executive branch officials. It can no longer rest, as I thought at one time, on the divide between those who exercise policy responsibility and those who do not. I do not think it can be seriously questioned that independent counsel have and use enormous policy discretion. My guess is that removal restrictions are now more defensible when they relate to officials subject to significant judicial oversight, those whose function is primarily to litigate. Perhaps it was not so far-fetched when counsel for the House of Representatives argued in Morrison before us that Congress could even limit the president's authority over the Solicitor General, so long as the effectuating power to do so was transferred to the judiciary. That one should always look carefully in separation of powers cases to discover the judiciary's real interest was made even clearer, in my view, in the case of Public Citizen versus Department of Justice. There, three members of the court, including two of the majority in Morrison, explicitly determined that the Advisory Committee Act was unconstitutional as applied to the ABA Judicial Selection Committee because it interfered with the exercise of the president's appointment power. The majority, as you may recall, imaginatively interpreted the statute as not applying to the ABA to avoid the constitutional issue. Morrison's balancing test, at least in the concurring opinion, was eschewed ostensibly because the president's appointment power over judges is textually explicit, whereas authority over removal of executive branch officers is implied. Of course, this is probably inconsistent with the Supreme Court's language in Bauscher, recognizing that authority to fire is even more important than hiring and controlling subordinates. Be that as it may, as all the world knows, the ABA's advisory committee has become more of a check on the president's appointment power than an enhancement. And it is a check that all too often is wielded by behind the scenes by members of the judiciary themselves. It is often said that Morrison v. Olson, like U.S. versus Nixon, stands for the proposition that in our democracy, no man, even the president, is above the law. But it is judges who apply, and sometimes, as in the Supreme Court, make law. Therefore, when considering how strong the concept of the unitary executive remains in separation of powers jurisprudence, one should bear in mind that it has and probably always will give way to another notion, which I cautioned against, in my Morrison opinion, judiciary uber alles.
Shows the technical expertise of agency officials in screwing this up. I normally begin these talks recently by saying it's nice to be back in front of a relatively friendly academic audience after coming to Washington, where I feel a little bit like when I was selected for my team in high school and the coach said, "You're on the javelin team, get out and receive." When Judge Silberman advised me at lunch that this recent symposium of separation of powers symposium in George Washington just basically consisted of a bunch of second-rate articles, including mine, I began to wonder whether or not that was actually correct. I'd like to talk a little bit about this notion of formalism, and formalism being a dirty word. I'm not against formalism or literalism in constitutional adjudication. I think it has a very important role there. What has concerned me a little bit is the way in which some of the techniques of literal interpretation that dominate and properly dominate our constitutional adjudication also have come to dominate much of our public dialogue about these issues. I think to the extent of impoverishing some of our ability to think about these issues. So I intend today to talk a little bit about the unitary executive from the standpoint not simply of constitutional law or is it required by the Constitution, but to pick up on Steve Breyer's point that we should also consider the wisdom and the policy advantages. The basic notion is that the unitary executive theory is not only a good thing because it's required by the Constitution, which in my view it is, but also it should be defended on the grounds that it results in better decisions. So going back to the first point for a minute, when I was over for my briefing for new presidential appointees at the White House not too long ago, Roger Porter was telling a story about a flight back from St. Louis with the president, where he and the president were alone together for a period of time and got into a deep and Roger, who is a very, very bright guy, said a very provocative and telling discussion on the question of why was it that the framers of the U.S. Constitution were so wise, this group of little 400,000 people living on the eastern seaboard produced Madison, Jefferson, and all the rest. And they came to the view that maybe it was because the questions that the framers put before themselves were somewhat different. They asked questions about what type of government structure would lead to good results. I've been trying ever since to figure out how to tell Roger Porter and the president that thought is the last paragraph of this second-rate article I wrote in the George Washington Law Review. And I finally came upon the notion the best way to do that is to tell this story at some conference and just assume it will work its way back. But in any event, part of my beef with the notion of a formalistic jurisprudence is that it impoverishes the thinking of lawyers and judges and our public debate about how government works or what history teaches are the characteristic flaws and weaknesses in particular governmental designs. I think the reason that this impoverishment of the public debate is so important is that the predominant thing about our Constitution on many of these issues of government structure, and this is where I agree with Steve Breyer again, the predominant characteristic of our Constitution is really its lacuna. Most of, or many of the important question, I think this is a point Peter Strauss has made, many of the most important things that we need to deal with as issues of governmental structure, we can find very little guidance for in the words of the Constitution. We are in many ways building institutions in the holes or the great silences of the Constitution. So let me turn then to the policy question of whether or not an interagency review process, a unitary executive, subjecting the decisions, yes, even of an EPA, to the views and opinions of others, can be defended not only on grounds of constitutional theory, but on more practical grounds of good government and political theory. I think the answer to that question is clearly yes. I think that decisions that emerge from the government process are much better decisions, much wiser decisions, as a result of the review process that takes place within a unitary executive than they would be if we had the strong theory of agency autonomy. And to make it more specific, I think the decisions that we reach in the environmental area are sounder decisions, better decisions, wiser decisions, more balanced decisions, better government, because the results that EPA might reach if left to its own under a strong autonomy view are hammered out and tempered by the interagency review and unitary executive process within the executive branch. And what's important about this, I suppose, is not only that I think that based on my very limited tenure at EPA, but that Bill Riley thinks that too. He said so the other day in a meeting, that he thinks as a result of the OMB review process, we probably come to better decisions than we would without it. I think the explanation for that, at least in my view, or at least the beginnings for that, is set out in, I think, a very important article by Lloyd Cutler and Johnson, that was published in the Yale Law Journal in 1975, called Regulation in the Political Process. I really recommend it to anyone who's interested in this area. It's a very important article for two reasons. One, I think it gives us some very valuable historical perspective about how different our governmental structure is today, with OIRA and the OMB process playing such a major role, from what it was perceived as being as recently as 15 years ago in 1975. Because in that article, Cutler and Johnson argue strongly that we need to consider whether and how to create a system for continuous political monitoring of all government regulation. And they have a specific proposal for how to do that, which would basically give the president authority to trade off the various goals of single mission agencies. Now, they made one mistake. They built into their proposal a legislative veto. Apologies to my friend Ted Olson. But other than that, I think the article wears remarkably well. And I think one of the reasons we need a unitary executive is because almost all agencies have a single-mindedness of purpose about their goals and their values. There is a natural process of self-selection that takes place in government. Those people who tend to go to work for the Environmental Protection Agency tend to be people who think environmental values are very important. They probably, by definition, think environmental values are more important than the population of the United States does generally, or they wouldn't have chosen to make that their life's work. And so, of course, we believe, I believe, that environmental values probably should trump most other other values, or at least many people. I can't say I believe that, but I probably believe they're more important than many other people do. What happens in the interagency review process is we and every other agency is required to justify its decisions in a process of debate, of dialogue, of weighing and balancing against other competing goals and values. So DOD comes in, the Department of Defense or the Department of Energy comes in and tells us and forces us to listen to and pay attention to what the consequences of some of the things that we're doing will be for the other important goals and values of our society and our political process. I think it's unfortunate that many of my colleagues who are very much in favor of liberal dialogue and debate, that's a very popular theme in the academy these days, don't recognize that the unitary executive theory and the OMB and Justice Department reviewing roles really bring that same need for dialogue among people with competing values and the harmonization of your values with another person's values through dialogue. That's what the process is all about. So that it won't be too Panglossian, let me say I think that the major shortcoming in the process, at least as I've experienced it to date, is that it's awfully cumbersome, and it's not as speedy as perhaps it might be. And I think as this process develops further, it's likely that we'll try to make the process not delay things as much as it does now. Right now, you're not only talking about OMB and the Justice Department and a lot of other individual agencies, but there can really be a very, very long process of interagency review and comment. Just in a in the thought I'd like to leave you with in closing is that the OMB process, the OIRA process, and its reliance on cost-benefit analysis is often misunderstood by my students, particularly in environmental law, because it compares the benefits of a particular program, such as the environmental benefits of something we'd like to do, with the cost of doing so. And students, as Frank Easterbrook knows, or Steve Breyer knows, or Steve Carter knows, are very, very fond of saying, well, yeah, but environmental values, it's just money on the other side. Why not? What people often miss is that the money on the other side is a way of measuring all the other things we could do with those resources. And so therefore, in some sense, the money is the cost-benefit process is a way of trading off our environmental values against all the other competing values that the society might pursue. I guess in closing, I'd just like to say that I think the unitary executive and the interagency review process and so on is really, in an interesting way, a kind of microcosm of the framers' vision of separation of powers in government more generally. That is to say, those who wish to use the power of government to go forward to pursue their particular goals and objectives are required to run a virtual gauntlet of other institutions with competing values so that if something is to be done using the power of the federal government, it has to pass through a number of checks and be approved from a number of different perspectives. That strikes me in the long run not only as being constitutionally required, but as in resulting in much better and wiser government decisions. Thank you.
It's good to be here. I should begin this with at least some delight that there still is, at least in a few minds, such thing as the unitary executive. And I remember when I came to Washington in 1983 to join the Justice Department, it was March of 83, and something happened the first week I was there which educated me as to the nature of the modern state. Ted Olson, I'm sure, remembers this quite well. We were seated around the Attorney General's conference table early that morning, reading our news clips, which, by the way, is another way in which unity in the executive is fractured. We were reading the news clips that morning, and we all were reading the stories about how the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Smith at the time, had somehow been censoring these films that were coming in from Canada dealing with acid rain. And of course, I being new and naive and just up from someplace other than Washington where you have to understand this particular arcana, I thought, of course, that the president was responsible, and in fact, he had probably ordered this censorship, and probably through Bill Smith, and I'm sure Ted Olson had something to do with it. He generally would get in trouble. And, of course, Bill Smith, it turned out, was stunned. He didn't know about it either. Neither did Ted Olson, neither did anyone else. In fact, down in the criminal division, a GS-12 was applying a particular statute, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And he had a particular job to do, and he would see whether these films from another country comported with current policy, and he would act accordingly. So much for the theory, I guess, of the unitary executive. No, it was not the president nor one of his chief aides who was doing this, but it was just simply the routine nature of the business inside the Justice Department. I point this out only to make the observation that the government is much, much larger. The administrative state is much larger today than it was before, and this is, as we shall see, in these remarks, I think one of the reasons for the problem today of the unitary executive. I would like to explore this topic less from the narrow legal questions that are implicated by agency rulemaking. And instead, at a gathering like this, I think it might be appropriate, I would like to explore the notion of unity from the standpoint of the Federalist Papers. The question is, why did the framers think unity, as they called it, in the executive, important and even necessary? And the answer has to do with their particular science of politics. In the 11 essays on the executive branch, all by Hamilton toward the end of those papers, we find unity listed as a so-called ingredient of something else, that is to say, energy in the executive. The other three ingredients are duration of office, by which he meant the four-year term, and re-eligibility, which, as we know, has been done away with. An adequate provision for the executive support, by which he meant adequate salary. There's some aides who may quarrel with whether it's sufficiently adequate today. Also, competent powers, as Hamilton called it, by which he meant the constitutional powers listed in Article 2. These ingredients, when brought together in the same mixing bowl, give you energy. In a moment, I'll come back to this particular ingredient of unity. But here, I think it is important to focus on what unity, in combination with these other things, gives you. Energy was critical to the framers' understanding of the new constitutional order. In the 70th number of the Federalist, Hamilton writes, famously, as we know, that energy in the executive is a leading characteristic of good government. An energetic, independent executive was important for two reasons. One was administrative, and the other was political. And both of these reasons were rooted in the experience of the 1780s. The administrative and the national experience, and the political and the state or colonial experience. Under the Articles of Confederation, the actual administration of the national government had proved extremely difficult. It was widely recognized that there needed to be some independent entity that could carry out the task, that is to say, to execute the laws. And it was believed that only an energetic body could do this. At the same time, the experience in the states had demonstrated something else, and this was that legislatures themselves can threaten the liberty of the people. There needed to be some way to contain what John Marshall then called the wild projects of the moment that seemed to emanate routinely from legislative bodies. An executive, again, was needed for this political job as well, and because the executive in this understanding had to act as a force against the legislature, he would need, by definition, to be energetic. I think Hamilton was smack on when he understood the veto power as an ingredient of energy. Energy, then, was the precious commodity in the framers' political science. It was lacking in the old order, and it needed to be supplied in the new one. Even so, let us note with some care Hamilton's formulation. Energy in the executive is a, not the, leading characteristic of good government. Hamilton does not equate good government simply with an energetic one, and we should be glad that the article he used was a and not the. Totalitarian governments, after all, can be energetic. Again, in Federalist Number 70, Hamilton clues us in on what else is a leading characteristic of good government. A due responsibility is the way he puts it. Here we come upon the connection between power and the people who grant the power. Good government is government accountable to the people. It recognizes it has no power but that granted to it by the people. Energy and a due responsibility in the executive are together, we might say, the leading characteristic of good government. This much of the framers' political science sketched, I would like to return to the matter again of unity. Unity arose at the founding in terms of whether the executive should be a unity or a plurality, one person or a council or a committee. Hamilton explains why the convention's choice of unity is superior to the alternative of a plurality, and I think it is a measure of the success of this choice that we have forgotten much of what this old argument was about. It was about both energy and accountability. In the minds of the framers, especially, of course, Hamilton's, unity and speed and vigor went together. Plurality and relative slowness also went together. By the way, I should observe that Hamilton does not quite come thoroughly clean here. The executive power is far more complicated than this. Indeed, in discussing the pardon power, it is clear that it's not simply speed and vigor, but also deliberation that the executive has to have. Hamilton, in a later paper, not in the Federalist Papers, in fact, equates energy ultimately with what he calls wisdom. Perhaps one reason people want to get the executive power is it is so interesting. The American people, in any event, it was thought, could better assign responsibility for exercises of the executive power when it was vested in a single person as opposed to a council. Unity was essential then to energetic government, and unity was essential to an accountable government. I lay all of this out. It may seem off the beaten path for this discussion, but it seems to me related to this conference. These are historical and political perspectives drawn from the founding, and I think it does produce a starting point for reflection. Consider that if the executive department had only a single person, he could indeed act his own mind in his own opinion, and we could see him acting. Depending on who he is, his strengths and his weaknesses, we could see his energy, we could hold him accountable. This, of course, is an exercise purely in theory. The executive department could not possibly be so small, although I am intrigued to notice that Washington reviewed all of the correspondence going out from the executive department. Adams did not, by the way. Jefferson praised Washington for his energy and for preserving what he called unity quite correctly. In any event, a president needs aides, as we know. Fisher Ames said that the aides are the arms and the ears and the eyes of the president. And he needs them. And the history of the federal government is simply, in brief, that he needs more and more and more aides. There are a lot of those aides in this room at the moment. There's a certain obvious dynamic at work here, which is that the larger the executive department gets, the more the likelihood that the executive will be less unitary. This is so, I think, regardless of the growth of congressional staff or subcommittees or other external developments. It is so because of human nature. Faction, indeed, is sown in the nature of man. People differ in many ways, and so it has been from the Washington administration to the Bush administration. I venture this as a proposition, even as a corollary, that the less unitary that the executive department becomes through its own expansion, that the less energetic the president might be, at least in the administration of government. Paradoxically, and to put it differently, the more energetic he has to be if he is to be a unitary executive. One argument for smaller government, incidentally, is that it may reduce the natural tendency towards disunity. That is a result we may like if we prize energy in the executive, which I happen to do. Modern times have worked in favor of disunity in the executive, as I have noted. One reason, again, is the rise and growth of the modern administrative state and the rise and growth of congressional staff and committees that others have noted. This, of course, implicates the questions addressed to this panel. Here I would like to observe, though, that these are not the only things that work towards disunity. There is, as well, a non-official political culture, that is, I call it in short, Washington, which itself tends to pull the executive apart. The many interest groups that collect here are part of this culture. Certain agencies or departments can become the captives of these groups, in which case a kind of divorce between the agency and the president can occur, especially in a conservative administration, because the Washington political culture is primarily liberal. Bill Bennett tells the story of his arrival at the National Endowment for the Humanities and being told by a staffer that the groups were ready to meet with him, an invitation he refused. So the groups always are ready to meet. Incidentally, what makes the group's presence so difficult for most executive appointees to ignore is that the appointees tend not to know much about what they are doing, especially if they have arrived here just recently. And precisely because government is so large and there are so many other priorities, a president is hard-pressed, especially early on in an administration, to provide specific guidance to an agency like NEH. Here, I think it interesting to observe that Bennett and his colleagues never received any guidance from the White House, as they tell me, as to what their agenda should be. They had to make it up. And they had to hope it conformed, by the way, to what the president, if he thought about it, would have wanted. In other words, they had to hope that their eyes and arms and ears and hands, to quote Fisher Ames again, were Ronald Reagan's. It is possible, if for no other reasons than the size of government and national priorities, for agency department heads to become many presidents. A president must hope that they are doing his will. Congress, of course, may have other ideas about what any given appointee is doing. There are two other things that work towards disunity. I've been told I have less than 2 minutes now, and I'll just note these in passing. One is the national media, whose rise in sheer numbers and power has been rapid in the past 3 decades. When David Stockman had breakfast 18 consecutive Saturday mornings in 1981 at the Hay Adams with William Grider, he was well on his way towards fracturing the executive branch and draining the executive of unity. Still another way that that occurs is through either criminal, unethical, or imprudent behavior, particularly with the kind of laws and the special prosecutor culture that others have noted that we now have. In short, how does a president overcome all of these forces that work against him? We can blame Congress, we can blame judges, but I will also say that the executive himself can be a co-conspirator. And an executive needs to be energetic if he is to preserve his energy and his unity. Thank you.
Well, we're now supposedly, I think, each allowed about 2 minutes, is that right? For to say the 40 or 50 minutes worth of stuff that we cleverly will disguise as a question. So I'll have about two minutes of comment. And I was interested in what each of my fellow panelists said. Look, I'm thinking of an example to try to make my point. What's, I think, very tough about this subject is it's so hard to think about it without either doing so in totally abstract terms, which are useless, or thinking about it in terms of particular policies, and then what you like comes into play. E.g., I don't think it's a good idea to have a unitary executive if that means centralizing the decision-making in the White House for whom you should prosecute criminally. Think that's a good idea? I bet you don't. And I'm certainly going to have second thoughts if I think what you mean by that is that the president himself should decide himself who gets every radio and television license. I don't know that that's such a good idea. But you talk to me about what I think are the issues of the day, or I see a crying need for centralization of environmental policy, because I personally think that would be a more effective policy, more bang for the buck and more bang, all right? And I think safety, risks, et cetera, and all the other things which I love as a student of regulation, which everybody else finds boring, I think they'll work better if you centralize it, okay? And so it's hardly surprising I sort of go for that. But what we should do is abstract from those issues of the day if we can do it, and I don't know how to do it. Now that's my second point. My second point is I can think of a few reasons, politically speaking, to give these things to the White House. A lot of them, not prosecutions. But what? What we all know, as Don spelled out, as Terry began to spell out very well, the individual agencies are a mass of pressure groups. Is the president immune from that? I remember the story that someone who once worked for a president told me years ago. I think it was Millard Fillmore. I think that was the president. Millard Fillmore one day was sitting there, and somebody asked him which airline should get the route. And the assistant in the White House wrote a little memo saying, Millard, there's airline A and airline B. Airline A gave us a lot of money in the campaign. The president, Millard, was furious. He ran out and he said, never write a memo like that. He said, come in and tell me. Right. I mean, it isn't, they're not immune. But we do know this, that the political pressures are general upon the president, and he's a politically responsible official, not a non-elected official. And he's paid to do that. And that cuts a little bit in favor, generally speaking, of the White House being responsible. But my final sentence is that because these matters can shift over time, because the issues of the day can change, Again, it isn't surprising to me that the constitutional doctrine is liberal enough, by and large, to keep the courts out. Indeed, Congress says the courts under the Constitution can give civil servants tenure. Congress can give adjudicatory officials like Humphreys and the FTC and Wiener and so forth, adjudicatory officials tenure. Congress could even give a special prosecutor a special kind of pressure. You know, I doubt that Congress could tell the president he can't fire the Secretary of State, all right? Leeway, not absolute. But why a lot of leeway? For the two reasons I said. They're political considerations, it's tied to substance, and they change over time. Now, those are my 2 minutes. Larry.
Well, first of all, I hasten to say that I did not refer to Professor Eliot's article as a second-rate article.
Third.
I thought some of the other articles that appeared along with his suffered by comparison. I did think there was something tentative about his article, which I expected would stiffen after a few years in the executive branch, when I wouldn't be surprised if he sounded a little bit more like his colleague, Professor Carter. On one point that Steve Breyer mentioned in his opening talk and alluded to again, it's a very interesting question. He said Congress doesn't delegate the interpretation or application of laws to the president, but rather to subordinates. There is a very interesting question, not really decided, although I have to confess I did write an opinion that suggested that, more than suggested, the president did have the power to oversee directly his subordinates' interpretation and application of the law under a broad range of circumstances. Wiener, which is a quasi-judicial situation, is quite different, and it is different because it's quasi-judicial. I also think the civil servant, that is to say that the congressional power to prevent the president's discharge of the civil servants is, as I discussed in the Morrison opinion, really quite different too, because there's no, theoretically, the civil servant isn't making policy, but works for an individual somewhere along the line who does make policy and who, prior to Morrison, was thought removable by the president. One other point, which I alluded to in my talk, but I want to come back to, cannot be said more often. Enough, cannot be emphasized enough. If one thinks of separation of powers as totally a management principle for organizing government, a structure of organizing government, if you think of it only in those terms, you're more inclined to appreciate Steve Breyer's approach as, gee, the court should not get involved, and this is just a question of how boxes are organized. And unless it really offends blatantly something in the Constitution, let's not be troubled. What that, in my view, totally ignores is that separation of powers was designed to protect the American people against too much accretion of government. And even if the president and the Congress and the judiciary all together decide that they will obliterate the limitations that came from the brow of Montesquieu, it is fundamentally wrong because it impacts on American citizens, and as nowhere was that more clear in my judgment, nowhere is it more clear in my judgment that when it involves, still in my judgment, the unconstitutional prosecution of citizens. That's all.
As I am longer in the academic business, I begin to realize that the equivalent of a tour to promote your book, in which you go on talk shows, is to come to conferences and talk about your articles so that other people can, you can encourage other people to read them. So I don't care how this article is rated, so long as people spell the citation correctly. The title, for those, since you ask, is Why Our Separation of Powers Jurisprudence is So Abysmal, a provocative title. In my prepared remarks, I tried to resist the temptation to discuss cases with the two judicial members of the panel. That proves to be an irresistible temptation for a law professor. But since I was arguing about the over-judicialization and the over-literalization of our political dialogue about these issues, it seemed to me that I ought not, in my own remarks, fall prey to the tendency that I was myself criticizing. However, now I can't resist. I think I disagree with Steve Breyer's prediction that the Mistretta, the Sentencing Commission case, necessarily represents the future, or is likely to represent the future, of our separation of powers jurisprudence, as opposed to Bauscher. People in the literature, I think maybe Peter Strauss coined this, but people in the literature have talked about two tendencies, functionalism and formalism, in our separation of powers jurisprudence. And I think it's the case that Jeff Miller and Steve Carter and I, and we've all written kind of about this one way or another. I don't like the terms much. I agree with you, formalism isn't really the right word. One problem that we always face in legal academia is if we don't use the same words that are already established, if we all invent our own private languages, then we don't have any kind of cumulative effect. But in any event, I think these two tendencies, which I think are reflected sort of alternately in Supreme Court opinions, are really both generated by the same fixation on literalism as the jurisprudential underpinnings for our separation of powers jurisprudence, which is why I say the separation of powers jurisprudence is abysmal. Not that the results are wrong, but that we failed to really develop over time a cumulative wisdom in the separation of powers area through the judicial process. And there, I disagree with Judge Silberman. I think that the primary contrast is to something like the First Amendment. I think that we have constructed incredible intellectual edifices under the First Amendment. They may be right, they may be wrong, but it ain't formalistic. Whatever it is, there's a tremendous body of lore there. I don't see a similar creativity in the judicial elaboration of separation of powers principles. With that point, let me just remark very quickly on the point about Morrison versus Olson. With all due respect to Ted, I think that's a pretty good opinion. I think it's not popular here, but you know. And I think one of the reasons I think it's a pretty good opinion is that the court seems to me to begin to get beyond particular results and address some of the structural and conceptual issues about how the framework of governmental design should be made to work better. So my response to Judge Silberman is that in the hypothetical that an independent prosecutor.
Thank you. Since we are in fact mentioning our own articles and books and things, nobody else is doing that but me, Terry. I'm glad I feel much better.
I have a lot of opinions.
Since we're mentioning judicial opinions, I did write a book called Ethics, Politics, and the Independent Counsel. With the rather forbidding subtitle, Executive Power, Executive Vice, 1789 to 1989. In any event, I swore myself not to talk about that subject here. Actually, what I would like to do instead is pick up on one comment Don Elliott's regarding the tendency of the legalisms to impoverish our public debate. Perhaps I want to take that point in a slightly different direction. I think there is a reason, perhaps, that will help us understand why presidents don't tend to invest themselves into, for example, agency rulemaking and other issues. A reason that they don't insert themselves into administrative processes and parts of government. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but I want to describe the reason. The reason is that a president also has political responsibilities, and a president has come to be expected, certainly in the age since Woodrow Wilson, to be a rhetorical president. Ronald Reagan performed according to form, according to expectation, when during his first year in office, he came out on February 18 with a large, substantial, ambitious, economic recovery program, the economy having become the president's one of his chief responsibilities. He went on national television and made speeches and got votes. We all know the history of that. That was the rhetorical presidency in action. And notice the bang for the buck you get as a president. You can get a victory, a tangible victory. And so you invest yourself in that kind of cause. I think that the attractions, the possibilities of that, and by the way, there are considerable downsides with the rhetorical presidency. It has rarely worked as some think it has worked, at least to the benefit of the government. But I think that we ought to consider that political attraction that a president has. And when you consider that you only have finite time, presidential time, as I call it, is 4 years times 365 days times the number of hours. That's all the time you've got. You have to make priorities. And especially when you have what was called stagflation in 1981, it was certainly not an unreasonable priority for what that president did. Just hold that thought for one moment. It's difficult to compare or to criticize one presidency by another. I think the study of the presidency teaches that they are highly particular entities and people. But George Bush, here in the ninth year of the Reagan-Bush administration, George Bush is in fact, I think, a very interesting, almost 19th century president. He's not the rhetorical president. He does not give speeches. He hates speeches. He's given two speeches on national television. Neither one of them was to push legislation. It was not to rally popular support. But he has vetoed 10 bills. Reagan vetoed two in his first year. Some of those bills, in fact, were not just policy bills, but they, in fact, threatened the prerogatives of the president. This president also has, I think, a keen understanding of some of those things I was talking about in Hamilton, perhaps, of secrecy and dispatch, something, by the way, that is not liked in the Fourth Estate, naturally, because there is a sense in which he must be held accountable and tell us what he's going to do about Panama and China and other things. But I think that it's interesting to observe that while we may worry about the degree to which a particular president might do according to as we might want him to do, this president we have now does seem to be tending to the office in a way that is remarkable. He has prevented leaks. We have not had the kind of leaks that you had in the first year of the Reagan administration. And he has also had no ethics problems with his people. This, in fact, has helped his unity, and it's helped him have energy in the areas he wants to have energy in.
Thank you. Now, we have time for questions. Quite a few, Mr. Hertzfans, where there was one. Yes. Can't see it.
Yes, my name is Alden Abbott.
Yeah, would you want to introduce yourselves as you? I can't see, unfortunately.
Yes, my name is Alden Abbott. Quick question about independent agencies. I wonder if Judge Silberman might like to comment on such peculiarities, the fact that the SEC is allegedly, well, statutorily given the power to file its own briefs before the Supreme Court without having to receive permission for such filings in the Justice Department. That's just one example of, it seems to me, a clearly unconstitutional creation of a power that cannot be checked by the executive. And yet there doesn't really seem to be any near-term prospect for court action to limit such unconstitutional statutory incursions. I wonder if Judge Silberman might have some general comments on that.
May I answer the question without assuming, as your question assumes, that the practice is unconstitutional?
Yes, you may indeed. I'm just doing it for rhetorical effect.
I understand. Well, as you may know, there is a statute giving the FTC, which had recently exercised authority to seek certiorari without the approval of the Solicitor General. It has done so twice, and twice the Supreme Court has granted cert. As the burden of my talk should have suggested, going back to U.S. versus ICC, when incidentally, to make Terry's point, the government, the Justice Department, argued in the Supreme Court that they could be adverse to the ICC because they wanted a short-run advantage out of it. They wanted to sue as a shipper. And Frankfurter dissented and said it wasn't justiciable. But it makes Terry's point that often it's the executive branch itself that shoots itself in the foot in that. The ICC versus the United States, however, is the and Nixon versus the United States and Morrison v. Olson are such major props in the chopping away of the unitary executive, I regard the issue that you raise, which is whether or not an independent agency can appear separately in the Supreme Court, to be the kind of thing as to be sort of small bore left. And again, my point, my thesis was that the Supreme Court looks quite convivially at splitting the executive branch in any kind of litigation forum, because that, and I didn't mean to put this too harsh a way, human nature being what it is, but that enhances the judicial power.
Well, does anybody else want to comment on that besides me? Because I have to say, I think the judiciary has a tremendously strong institutional interest in making certain that there is coordination of legal positions within the executive branch. And indeed, you look at European countries, and I have the chance to go with some French people, have something called the Conseil d'État, and you go to the Justice Department. I mean, there they coordinate substantive regulatory policy, and after all, ours is primarily a government interested in regulation. That's what they do. They hand things out and they regulate. Right, and they coordinate that through one central body, which is politically responsible eventually through the cabinet, and legal positions are coordinated as well. And each person, you'd think that would happen here, legally through the department, but somebody, some particular group gets upset about a particular matter that they think the department's run wrong about, they run to Congress, get an exemption, and the result is a judge, like me or you, sees incoherent positions, different positions taking different place in the government, and then when they get to the Supreme Court, it gets coordinated. Well, that's a little irritating. So I think we have a strong institutional interest in seeing that the government's legal authority is coordinated in a single place.
But that's only if you have a certain view of the judiciary, which Judge Breyer has, and I commend.
Well, all right. Nick, where are we now? Let's go over to this side. Yes.
Yeah, Gary Lawson from Northwestern Law School. Mm-hmm. Judge Silberman, I was delighted to have you raise what I think is the key question here, and that is the effect of a statute that purports to vest authority directly in subordinate officials. I'd like to see just how much trouble you're willing to get yourself into. Let's take a... Let's take a particular example. The Tea Importation Act of 1896 tells the Secretary of HHS to promulgate standards for the purity, fitness for consumption, and quality of imported tea. Right? Well, suppose the president is a tea fancier and one day happens to be flipping through the Code of Federal Regulation, comes across the 9 pages of regulations on tea standards, decides that they're lousy standards, writes up his own set, sends them through whatever the appropriate process is, off they go to the Federal Register to be printed. Is that a valid regulation?
Well, you know better than I expect that I'd answer that question, but I will say, this. The one silver lining I found in the majority opinion in Morrison v. Olson was Justice Rehnquist accepting of the notion, which he several points explicitly does, that the take care that the laws be faithfully executed is both a duty and a source of authority upon the president. In that series of law reviews in George Washington, in which Professor Eliot's splendid piece appears, there is an article by another author which suggests, as did my colleague on the Court of Appeals, Judge Ginsburg, that clause is not a grant of authority to the president to ensure any particular interpretation of the laws. I think there is, in the Supreme Court opinion of Morrison v. Olson, the suggestion that there is a presidential duty. Now, how far that goes, what he could do, how he could deal with some of the hypotheticals you raise and which Judge Breyer raised, I'm not prepared to say, since we'll probably have it before our court next week.
I'd like to address that issue as well, although not in the particular statutory context you posed, Gary. I'm not as familiar with the Tea Act as you are. And I'm speaking really in my capacity as a law professor rather than as a general counsel of EPA. What that means is that the staff hasn't had a chance to brief me on this yet and tell me that I'm wrong. We have it in the environmental statutes an interesting difference in that most of our statutes refer to the administrator, but some of them refer to the president, and then there's a delegation from the president to the administrator. And my perception is it makes not one iota of difference. In both instances, we are subject to the policy guidance and control of the president, as I believe we should be. And I think that the conversation is proceeding on the assumption that it makes a great deal of difference which word is used in the statute. I think that's not correct as a matter of law, at least in the environmental area. I grant that this issue has never been definitively and squarely resolved by the Supreme Court, but at least in the, a case with the not very helpful name of Sierra Club versus Costell, because there are so many of them, this is the coal-fired NSPS case in the DC Circuit. The argument was pressed quite hard on constitutional grounds by environmental groups led by my friend Bill Butler, that it was constitutionally impermissible for the White House staff to, quote, interfere with the policy deliberations by EPA in a statutory context where the statute, the Clean Air Act, confided the discretion in the administrator rather than the president. And the D.C. Circuit, in an opinion, I believe, by Pat Wall, made a very short shrift of that argument.
Yes, and President sort of Carter said, was president.
That's right. So much for formalism.
Jerry, just one comment on that. It seems to me in our system of separated power, such as we have regarded it from the beginning, it seems to me that, that in this system of separated powers that, that the president has to ultimately have the authority, whatever the statute might say. I think I agree with what Don Elliott just said about how it is written is less important. I do think, though, that it illustrates a central problem. Every 4 years in this country, we have an election, of course, and the media invests a tremendous amount of time and attention to it, and so do the American people, I guess. In popular psychology, and certainly during the election year, we have a unitary president. Only one president gets elected, I think. As soon as Election Day ends, though, we're back to the modern administrative state, and we're back to the plural executive that the founders argued against, and we're back to a notion of accountability that's different from the original one. It's an accountability to a Washington political culture. In fact, there were some anti-federalists, if I can use a mention of them at this society, who were worried about that phenomenon. One could analyze Washington in those terms today, but we as yet don't have the journalistic equipment, at least not in this city. Perhaps somewhere up in New York City, there's a newspaper that writes about this stuff. But someday, perhaps, people will understand this point.
My name is Gary Amos, and since the first Gary asked Judge Silberman a question dealing with microscopic detail, I'll ask you one that deals with extraterrestrial generalities. When you were first speaking about
the...
You
don't want to pose that question then to Judge Breyer? Forgive.
Well, as another professor, I have to protect our common interest.
Go ahead.
As you were speaking about the relationship of the courts and the executive branch, I was thinking about the different presidencies, particularly the one of Abraham Lincoln, which probably to this day continues to be one of the best evidences and examples of the need for a strong unitary executive. But my question is...
Jefferson Davis didn't think so.
Yeah. And... he no longer is in Richmond. How do you evaluate this proposition that one reason the doctrine of separation of powers has fallen on hard times is that the members of the two non-judicial branches no longer really believe, or at least do not really fully appreciate, that they have an independent duty to interpret the Constitution?
Well, while you're thinking about it, I'll answer that.
I was expecting I would like his answer. Let him try it first.
I wanted to give him time to
fine.
Think.
Go ahead.
Would you want me to
an hour?
Think about it first?
Again.
I'm not sure that
the right or duty or authority of members in both the executive and legislative branch to interpret the Constitution for themselves, independently or separately from the judiciary, constitutes a particular reason for the tensions in the separation of powers in over the last 20 years. I think it comes more from the competition between the executive branch and the Congress. In my talk, I suggested how the judiciary reacts to that. But I do not think that, as some had suggested back during the Reagan administration, that an independent authority that a more aggressive authority on the part of the president to assert the right to interpret the Constitution independently of the judiciary, is that what you're referring to, for instance?
That might be one example, but that is an example of an overall principle.
I mean, you could take this to the logical extreme of saying, well, now you've made your decision, try to enforce it.
Andrew Jackson.
As Andrew Jackson did. And I suppose that would reduce, that would cause a great constitutional crisis. But I don't see that really, frankly, has a lot to do with the executive branch versus legislative branch or vice versa, which has caused all the hydraulic pressure, I think, on the separation of powers problem over the last 20 years. Do you think, Steve? I pass it to you.
Well, I agree, but I wanted to tell you something that you told me at lunch, and maybe you didn't want. It was someone sitting next to someone at lunch. It was Judge Millard Fillmore. But what he said at lunch, which I thought was a very good point, which is directly relevant, is remember that the special prosecutor case came to you and then to the Supreme Court in the context of a law passed by Congress and signed by the president. Now think of the difference in attitude when you're facing a case which involves a Bill of Rights protection, fundamental freedom. That's not here. Or when the court is called to umpire under separation of powers doctrine, a dispute between two branches. And is that present in a case where both the president and the Congress have signed the law? Isn't there something odd about the president attacking a law? Not impossible, but it might give rise to the thought, if you thought this was unconstitutional, why did you sign it?
I suppose
that's... That's not a total disagreement. It's just that's an...
That's an interesting point, and I gather the corollary to that is that you would have thought Morrison v. Olson should have been decided the other way had the independent counsel statute been passed over the president's veto.
As the lone representative
of the executive branch defending against judicial hegemony and the principle of judiciary uber alles, which was referred to earlier, let me at least point out that I think that there are very important reasons that the executive branch and probably also the Congress ought to regard themselves as having an independent duty to abide by constitutional principles and to make judgments about constitutional principles. That is not, I would suggest, equivalent to defying the law as declared by the Supreme Court. But on the other hand, I think it is important that the executive branch continue to raise issues for the courts to decide. And it's also very important that the executive branch be thinking about these issues and making independent judgments about them. And I think, at least in the Reagan-Bush administration, executive branch has been thinking a lot about constitutional issues. I think that where the process has fallen down, perhaps, is in the Congress. And the Congress, I think, very, very seldom thinks about constitutional issues, or at least debates about constitutional issues so much. They frequently simply defer to the courts and say, well, we'll find out whether this is constitutional. And I would say, to put in a good word for formalism, I think one reason that they do that is that we've lost a tremendous amount of predictability in our constitutional law because so many of these cases are very particularistic and limited to their facts and influenced by political factors. And it's very difficult to have an interpretive process and to have a true constitutional law which people can think about in the absence of a jurisprudence that is at least formalistic enough that you can have theoretical, you can argue about theory, as opposed to just saying, as I think is in the case now in the separation of powers area, I think it's the clearest example of where there's very little consistent theoretical guidance and predictability to emerge from the Supreme Court opinions, as opposed to some of the really superior opinions that emanate from some of the so-called lower courts. I think we're really suffering from an impoverishment of our constitutional law generally. It makes it very difficult for others outside the judiciary to participate in these debates. But I certainly think the executive branch is trying very, very hard to develop some constitutional theory and think seriously about those issues, and it should be.
Terry.
Just want to say that I'm glad the fact that the president's signature did not influence you when you were writing your opinion. I don't think it should influence any court, but I do think perhaps it might influence a court. There might be some kind of psychological impact. This throws us back on the fact that the President of the United States, in this case Ronald Reagan, had two chances to veto the independent counsel statute. Someone might wish to argue as well that as soon as he came into office, he was under no obligation to enforce the law. That will take us into a quite different discussion, and I will not get into that at the moment. But let us say that the President had vetoed that statute in 1983, in January of 83, when in fact he signed it. I think he would have been much better positioned politically to have done so. He did not have the investigations of his own people, with the exception of Labor Secretary Donovan at the time. In 1987, in December, when he signed it a second time, it's clear that the political dynamic had thoroughly changed. I think, by the way, that President Bush, the political dynamic is much in his favor at the moment. Who knows what will happen in 1992, but that particular statute, since we're now talking so much about it, does expire by its own terms in 1992 on his watch. Given the fact that scandal is no respecter of institutional boundaries or parties, and that 1989 and 1990 are witnessing righteousness, the vengeance going on Capitol Hill with the right, the Quello, well, you name it, now the Keating Five. I think that this president might be well positioned simply to say this, that I will not sign any independent counsel reauthorization legislation that does not apply the law to members of Congress. I think the experience of Richard Phelan and the experience now of the Keating outside counsel would be a disincentive. Not that I believe it should be applied to the Congress or anyone else, but I do think that that would work tactically, perhaps, to get rid of the law.
Thank you. Judge Williams, I think this will be our last question.
My question is for you.
Thank you, Steve.
In a couple of, not on perhaps as broad as you might raise it, Larry. In a couple of strokes, you suggested the hazards of a unitary executive, and you named two areas, one, prosecutions, and the other, FCC licenses, I take it to be taken as a broader, suggesting broader themes. And you suggested the possibility, the likelihood of political favoritism, and also, I think, vendettas. And immediately they came to mind. But then one begins to think of it. Now, the independent FCC, it was reported in the first edition of Breyer and Stewart, as I recall, that in a 20-year period, every license issued had dutifully been to a licensed applicant who belonged to, and in fact, perhaps contributed funds to the political party of the president in office. That's what the independent FCC. Then one turns to prosecutions, and the question arises, it seems to me, whether there's any reason to think that the fear of a vendetta of some sort is any greater with a unitary president than with a splintered president. Now, there's a structural reason to see the opposite, that is to say an independent counsel charged with pursuing a particular person is almost politically directed to pursue a vendetta. So I guess my basic question is there anything either empirically or in terms of theory to suggest that both of these very legitimate fears are more engendered by splintering or by unification.
Institutions are complicated. I won't say the FCC is a model of perfection. I do think there is a thing called bureaucratizing a process. I think bureaucratizing is appropriate in the criminal justice process. It will never work perfectly. It's easier to bureaucratize the Justice Department than it is to bureaucratize the White House. There are other kinds of decisions for which that's totally inappropriate. Personally, I think television licenses from the White House would work worse than from the FCC, though I recognize that that's debatable. The general point is, there are prosecutions. There are handing out television licenses. There are investigations by inspectors general. There are adjudicatory proceedings in the judicial branch and in the executive branch as well. There are hosts of different tasks. Institutions must come in different shapes and sizes. There's nothing wrong with saying that one can have an executive branch made up of sub-institutions of different shapes and sizes. And if we don't like the particular shapes and sizes of many, and I don't, the appropriate remedy is to call that to public attention, explain how the particular sub-institution is working, and then ask Congress to change the ground rules. Cross our fingers and hope we get our way.
I'd like to address that briefly, if I might. I think Judge Williams is exactly right on this. I thought your two examples really worked not by the anomaly of having the president decide these issues, but rather by smuggling in an inappropriate factor as driving the decision that would be equally inappropriate whether the president or some other institution was involved. I also think the example worked in part by the oddity of the president with such limited time getting involved in such small issues. So it struck us as counterintuitive, but I really don't think structurally there was anything wrong with it. Having said that, let me raise one countervailing consideration, which I don't think is compelling. And that is our primary defense, the way we have built the administrative state against making these decisions based on inappropriate factors, is of course judicial review. And to the extent that the president makes these decisions personally on inappropriate factors, we are going to have to be, contrary to cases like CAB versus Waterman and others, in a situation of having the court review decisions personally by the president, which may make us a little bit uncomfortable in a constitutional sense. Having said all that, I still come out with Judge Williams on this one.
May I add one thing on
Please,
that point? It's an interesting twist of history.
Interesting.
When I became Deputy Attorney General in 1974, I found to my utter astonishment that every antitrust action brought by the Justice Department, every single one of any kind, any complaint, had to be signed by either me or the Attorney General. And I couldn't for the life of me understand why. And Tom Kuiper was the Assistant Attorney General for antitrust at the time. And I asked him why. He said, well, it's always been that way. And I said, well, let's check, find out why. Well, it turned out it was that way because when Thurman Arnold was Assistant Attorney General and Roosevelt was president, Thurman Arnold had a disquieting habit of suing contributors to the president's presidential campaigns. And the result of that was the Attorney General had to prove every antitrust complaint. We did change that. You can't think of a more unitary executive or more powerful one than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I'm not sure what that does to your hypothetical, Steve.
Terry, do you know, sir?
Well, just to follow up on that, it's an interesting question as to whether the unitary executive theory would require a political appointee accountable to the president, albeit perhaps indirectly, to sign off on every binding act by the executive branch. That is to say, can a no action letter be issued that binds EPA that no political appointee
ever
sees?
Oh, surely not. No one can bind EPA.
Oh, no, we bind ourselves all the time. The question that the question I'm really raising is whether or not it is a consequence of the unitary executive theories that people who are not directly accountable to the president and serve at his pleasure may act in the name of the executive branch of the United States in a binding way. I don't know the answer to that question. It strikes me as a difficult and troubling one,
yes,
and
right.
Perhaps it would be one that you'll write an illuminating opinion about.
So telling old Justice Department stories from the New Deal, there was, which we did not serve in. There's also one where the last Attorney General for Roosevelt, I forget who he was, it was in 44 or 45, fired his head of the Lands Division because I think he was prosecuting or about to prosecute someone who was a friend of one of Roosevelt's closest aides. So I guess this kind of coordination and control must have been very urgent during the
I'm not sure we're helping our cause for the unitary executive.
I think it's in the nature of the executive, though, sometimes to hide.
Well, I think we'll draw to a close, and thank you very much.